I've been on Tinder long enough to know most matches lead nowhere. A few awkward coffee dates, some guy too obsessed with the gym, others still living with their moms. But then, I matched with John. He seemed different. His profile mentioned he loved WWE, which made me laugh. I pictured him as one of those guys who rewatched old matches on YouTube, but otherwise was normal. We started talking. Within a few days, he asked if I wanted to come over for drinks. Against my better judgment, I said yes. I showed up around 9 p.m. His house was on the edge of town, the kind where the neighbors weren't close enough to hear if something went wrong. He opened the door smiling, and for a moment I felt lucky. He looked even better in person, tall, built, and clean-cut. I brushed off all my worries, thinking I'd need to stop indulging too much in true crime. The night started off fine. We sat in his living room with a bottle of wine and the conversation flowed. He was funny, attentive, and seemed genuinely interested in me. After a couple of glasses, he leaned in and kissed me, and it felt right. That kiss led to him tugging me gently toward the hallway. My nerves kicked in. I don't usually go to guys' bedrooms so quickly, but he made me feel comfortable, so I followed him. But as we stepped into his bedroom, my smile faded away. His bedroom wasn't a bedroom at all. It was a wrestling ring. I'm not exaggerating. A full-sized ring took up the entire room, completed with ropes, padded posts, and chairs hanging from the corners. The walls were plastered with WWE posters. John Cena, Undertaker, The Rock. A small TV sat on a stand, paused on a wrestling match. The floor around the ring was littered with weights, resistance bands, and half-drained protein shakes. My brain scrambled for an explanation.
Is this some kind of a joke? You didn't tell me you're into cosplay.
He laughed at me like I was being immature. Come on, it'll be fun, he said, holding out his hand. Step in the ring with me. I hesitated, but I didn't want to seem rude. I laughed nervously, slipping off my heels and climbed in under the ropes. Weirdly, for a moment, I imagined this might turn out to be a bit kinky, but there's no harm in experimenting. We kissed again, but this time, something changed. His hands grew rougher, his lips pressed too hard. Then, without warning, he shoved me back. It wasn't at all playful, but rather very aggressive. I stumbled, catching myself on the ropes.
Whoa, John! What the hell are you—
Before I could finish, he slapped me, hard, making my ears ring. I started crying, holding my cheek.
Stop it! Are you crazy?
He didn't apologize. Instead, he slapped himself across the chest while howling like a werewolf. Not just once. He kept slapping himself like it was turning him on. His face turned red and his eyes went wide.
Once you're in the match, you don't leave alive, and that's the bottom line, because John said so.
He laughed maniacally while tearing his shirt. His voice deepened, twisted like he was becoming someone else. My heart pounded. I tried to play it calm, edging towards the ropes.
Stop! You're hurting me!
I screamed, but he lunged at me. His hand slammed into my shoulder, shoving me into the corner post.
The spirits guide me, and the spirits demand pain.
I was bleeding from the corner of my lips. There were bruises on my face. It was a do-or-die situation for me. I ducked under his arm and scrambled beneath the ropes. My knees hit the floor hard as I crawled out of the ring. My only thought? Get to the door. Behind me, I heard the heavy thud of him landing on the ground after me. His laughter was wild, unhinged, and echoing in the cramped room. I sprinted barefoot down the hallway, bruises burning, adrenaline taking over.
You will bow at the feet of the ministry, or you will be destroyed.
He chased me, his footsteps pounding like war drums. I fumbled with the front door, my hands shaking so badly I almost couldn't turn the lock. But somehow I got it. The door flew open, and I bolted outside into the night. The cold air hit me, shocking me back into reality. I ran barefoot down the street, not daring to look back until I reached the glow of a gas station two blocks away. When I finally glanced over my shoulder, he was still standing in his doorway, watching me. His silhouette was huge against the dim light behind him, and then he cupped his hands around his mouth and shouted into the night.
I am the monster you fear when the lights go out!
That voice, it didn't sound human. It carried across the empty streets, chasing me even as I stumbled inside the gas station, crying, begging the clerk to call the police. By the time the cops showed up, John was gone. His house was dark, the rings still there, but no trace of him. They took my statement and promised to look into him, but I never heard what came of it. All I know is I escaped with bruises on my face, a sprained wrist, and a memory that still wakes me up at night. It's been months since that night, and I've deleted every dating app off my phone. But sometimes, when I'm lying in bed trying to fall asleep, I hear it again. All those spine-chilling things he said to me. I tried Googling those lines and realized they were quotes by famous wrestlers of WWE. The height of his obsession is terrifying. And sometimes, when the house is quiet, I swear I hear the squeak of rope stretching, like there's a wrestling ring waiting for me in the dark, because John's words don't leave me.
Once you're in the ring with me, you never leave the match alive.
And deep down, I know he meant it. I work for WWE as part of the production crew. Most people think it's all bright lights, roaring crowds, and fireworks, but someone has to stick around long enough after the fans leave to clean up, pack the gear, and lock up. That someone is often me. This incident happened after a late-night live show in one of the biggest arenas I'd ever worked in. By the time the last semi-truck rolled out, it was well past 1 a.m. The place felt eerie when it was empty. All the noise and energy abruptly ceased, replaced by a silence so heavy that you could hear the lights buzzing above. I was doing my rounds, checking doors, when I heard a distant crying. At first, I brushed it off as my imagination, but a few seconds later, the crying grew louder. It was the voice of a woman. Her sobbing suggested that she was in a lot of pain. I came out into the hallway. At my right, there was no one. But once I looked at my left, I saw her. She was standing in the middle of the hallway, maybe 15 to 20 feet away. The only thing visible on her face was her eyes, wide and still. The rest of her face was covered by a dirty, stained cloth. I thought maybe she was a lost fan or something who got stuck inside.
Hey, no need to cry. Do you need help?
She tilted her head slightly, then uttered in a muffled voice,
I live here. Down in the basement.
I frowned.
What? You mean you live here? In the area?
She nodded. I tried to laugh it off, but then controlled myself, thinking she must be mentally unwell.
Look, I'll call the cops. They'll help you get somewhere safe, okay?
She didn't respond, just kept staring. I pulled out my phone and called 911. I told them there was a trespasser inside the arena and they needed to send someone. But when I looked back up, she was gone. The hallway stood vacant. I tried to tell myself she slipped out through one of the side exits. Still, my intuition kept telling me she's still around. I decided to give it a check to be extra sure. I was almost at the end of the hallway when I heard the sound of running water from the men's washroom.
Ma'am, you can't stay here. The officers are on their way. They'll help you, okay? Please come out.
But she didn't come out. I had no other choice than to escort her out. The fluorescent lights flickered as I pushed the door open. She was standing at the sink, washing her face. The cloth was crumpled on the counter, and I saw the stains on it were of blood. My eyes darted back to her. Water poured from the faucet, but the drain was clogged, and the sink was filled to the brim. But it wasn't water. It was blood. I staggered back, my stomach flipping, but my eyes locked on her feet. Her toes. My God, they were curled unnaturally against the tile, blackened, swollen, and rotting. I shifted my eyes slowly from her feet to her face. She was just staring at me now, with no cover on her face. It was the most horrible face I've ever seen in my life. Her mouth was stapled shut with pins. The flesh around her lips was torn and swollen, jagged from infection. I fell onto the floor, shaking in fear and disbelief.
Ah! Who are you?
She stood still for a second, then began to smile. The skin around the staples stretched as she forced her lips into a grin. One by one, The pin started snapping loose, popping out of her flesh with wet, sickening sounds. Blood spilled down her chin as the smile widened far beyond what was human. Her body trembled with each motion, yet her eyes never stopped staring. I couldn't help but lie on the cold floor, drenched in sweat and terror. She kept smiling until the last pin broke free. Then, her mouth gaped wide open, pouring blood as she attempted to laugh. I never screamed louder than I ever had in my life. I finally got up and bolted for the exit. My shoes pounded the arena floor. I didn't dare look back. I swear, I could feel she was following me. I crashed through the lobby doors and nearly slammed into two uniformed cops rushing inside. Gasping for air, I grabbed one of them by the arm, blurting out everything. The woman, the sink full of blood, the staples. The officers exchanged a look, thinking I was mad. But still, they went in, guns drawn, while I followed at a shaky distance. We didn't find her in the bathroom, or the hallways, or anywhere else I'd seen her. But when we got to the basement, the part of the arena fans never see, that's when the smell hit us. We found a hidden storage room beneath the wrestling ring area, and inside was a body of a woman. Her mouth had been stapled shut. Her skin was bloated and gray, like she'd been dead for days or weeks. The cops looked shocked. They told me to wait outside while they called for backup. As I stood there, my mind kept replaying the sight of her rotten feet, the way her eyes glared into mine, and that grin splitting wider and wider as the staples tore free. It was later confirmed through an autopsy and investigation that someone killed her and left her body in the basement, thinking no one would ever find her. I can evidently say that whoever is responsible for this brutal murder has no conscience. The way her body was left, hidden under the auditorium, mouth stapled shut so she couldn't scream, tells me someone didn't just kill her. They wanted her silenced forever. And maybe on that night, I didn't see a living woman. Maybe I saw whatever was left of her, whatever refused to stay hidden in that basement. I don't usually talk about this. Most people in my life know me as someone who helps kids, someone who goes into schools and correctional homes to warn them about making reckless choices. But what I never say, the part I keep locked away, is that I do it because of something I did. Something that's haunted me every single night since I was 8 years old. It was a warm summer afternoon. My mom was out in the garden trimming roses. I was inside with my little sister, Mia. She was six. Mia and I were obsessed with WWE back then. Completely obsessed. We'd watch it on TV, admiring Undertaker, Triple H, and all those larger-than-life guys. That afternoon, I told Mia,
"Let's do the Undertaker's chokeslam."
She giggled like she always did, eager to play along. She trusted me too much. I grabbed her by the neck, pretending like I was in the ring. I lifted her, not even thinking about how small she was, how fragile. And then, I slammed her down.
Normally in these ads, you'd expect someone like me to ask you to buy something. But I want to ask you to do something different. I'm Dave Farenthold, and I'm a reporter for the New York Times. I'm an investigative reporter, which means that I follow the money, inside of government and outside of government. The point of my job is to find things people are trying to hide. It involves talking to lots of people. It involves looking through lots and lots of documents. And if there weren't folks like me to go beyond the surface to understand who is really shaping what the government does, the public would be left in the dark about what the government's doing with your tax money, what the government's doing to you through regulations and spending. If you're like me and you think this kind of journalism is important, seek out a news source that does firsthand, fact-based reporting. If that's the New York Times, thank you. If that's your local paper, that's great too, because where you get your information matters.
The sound that followed was something I'll never forget. Her head hit the floor with this crack, not like a toy breaking, not like something you could fix with glue. This was deeper, final. For a second, I thought she was just stunned, but then I saw it, the blood. a dark patch spreading quickly into the carpet beneath her head.
Mia?
I shook her. Her eyes fluttered, but she didn't answer.
Mia, wake up!
Panic clawed its way into my chest. My mom was right outside. If she saw this, if she knew what I'd done... I wasn't thinking like a sister. I was thinking like a scared kid who didn't want to get in trouble. That's the part that eats me alive. I dragged Mia across the floor, leaving streaks of red on the carpet, and stuffed her inside our wardrobe. She was so small, she fit right in. I shut the doors, pressed my back against them, like that would make it all disappear. But it didn't. At first, I just sat there, hands over my mouth, rocking back and forth. Then I heard a thud, a kick against the inside of the wardrobe, and then another. Mia's muffled cries told me she was awake. I should have opened the door. I should have run for help, but I didn't. Instead, I turned on my stereo, blasting music, trying to drown out Mia's cry for help. Every kick, every cry was like a nail being hammered into my skull. I remember pressing my hands to my ears, whispering over and over.
"It's okay. She'll be fine. She'll be fine."
But the noise went on. The wardrobe shook. It all continued for 5 to 10 minutes. Then, dead silence. I felt bile rising in my throat. I knew what just happened, yet I was too scared to admit it. I sat there, crouched on the floor, tears streaming down my cheek, hoping everything will go back to normal. But who can rewind time? When my mom finally came inside, she found me sitting on my bed, staring at the wall. She noticed the blood on the floor and called for Mia in full panic mode. She might have asked me, but I couldn't make out her words in my head. It was as if I were in a trance. I came back to my senses only when Mom opened the wardrobe.
Oh, Mia! Oh my God, my baby!
Her scream still rings in my ears. Mia was limp. Her lips were blue. The blood had dried in her hair. And I just sat there, frozen, while my mother's world collapsed in front of her. The next days were a blur. Police, questions, whispers from neighbors. I ended up in juvenile detention. They said it was an accident, but that didn't make me innocent. Years later, I built my life around that one afternoon. I studied child psychology. I became a counselor. I stand in classrooms now, looking into the eyes of kids who remind me of Mia, and I tell them not to copy stunts they see online. I tell them one wrong move can ruin lives. But here's the thing. I don't just remember that day. I relive it, because every night when I'm lying in bed, I hear it again. At first, it's faint, a shuffle, a soft knock. Then it grows louder, the rattling of wardrobe doors shaking in the dark. Sometimes, I hear Mia's voice.
Nelly! Let me out! I'm scared in the dark!
I know it's not real. I know it's guilt and trauma playing tricks on me. But it doesn't matter. Because when you've been the reason your baby sister stopped breathing, your brain doesn't care about logic. The rattling never stops. I've moved apartments, switched jobs, and even thrown out every wardrobe I've ever owned. But no matter where I go, no matter how safe or bright the room is, the sound always finds me. The worst part? Sometimes I see her. I'll wake up in the middle of the night, sweating, heart racing, and there she'll be. Mia, standing in the corner of my room, her little pajamas soaked in blood. Her head was tilted in that same unnatural way I last saw it, and her eyes, accusing. She doesn't speak when she shows up. She just watches me. Watches until I'm gasping for air, clutching the sheets, begging her to forgive me. Then, just as suddenly, she's gone. People tell me I've done good with my life, that I've redeemed myself by helping kids, but they don't know the truth. I didn't do it out of kindness. I did it because I'm trying to make up for something I can never undo. I know some people will say this is just guilt, that I'm punishing myself, but I don't think so. Because sometimes, late at night, when the wardrobe rattling gets too loud, it doesn't just stop like it used to. Sometimes, I swear I hear the door creak open, and then the room goes cold. And I know Mia's not just a memory. She's still here, waiting for me to open the door.